This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Well, it's official. Last month, June, was the hottest June on record for the U.S., and with cities in the Northeast, including New York, finishing up the week of over 90 temperatures, over 90 here, it's clear that the sizzling season is upon us. And here, city officials have opened cooling centers, they've kept public pools open later, and encouraged us to check on our elderly neighbors, all toward the aim of preventing hot temperatures from taking lives. And as the world continues to warm, is this going to become a greater risk? Is this the new normal? Research from Columbia University is putting a number, or rather a series of possible numbers, on a toll heat, that the toll that it could take on people living in New York City in the future. And under the most extreme scenario, more than 3,000 people could die each year. But other circumstances, we may only see a few hundred. Why can't we pick one number? Well, it all depends, my next guest says, on how hot it gets, but also our capacity to adapt. My guest is Lisa Vetipetkova. Lisa Vetipetkova is a project director at the National Center for Disaster Preparedness at Columbia University. She's an author on new research out in environmental health perspectives last month. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Petkova, didn't know that Columbia had a National Center for Disaster Preparedness.
Well, we're part of the Earth Institute at Columbia University, and our mission is to help the nation prepare, respond, and recover from various types of disasters, including natural disasters.
Wow. So let's talk about some of the heat advisories in New York City this past week, including one today, which is going to run until 7 p.m., hot enough for you, you know, is what people always say. But there are people who do not have air conditioning.
Yes.
In big cities, right?
Yes, this is true. And heat advisories are issued in New York City when the heat index, which is a measure that includes both temperature and humidity and basically explains how hot it feels. When this heat index reaches 95 and it stays over 95 for a couple of days, I think, the city issues this heat advisory. And it's very important for people, especially those who are more vulnerable, such as the elderly over 65 years of age, people with underlying health conditions such as cardiovascular, respiratory, to just make sure that they have access to cool environments, they prevent any heat-related illness, and they just take the appropriate measures to take care of themselves.
Dr. Petkova, are people surprised by when heat gets to them, that's surprised by it?
I think the interesting issue with heat is that it's always been around, and mm-hmm. people don't think of heat as a threat. People don't think of heat as a threat until it reaches a critical threshold where our bodies just start responding to it, and we are unable to have the regular thermal regulation to protect ourselves from the heat impacts. So it is very important to be prepared for such instances and know what the risks are and what the symptoms yeah. are of heat illness.
Well, give us some of those symptoms.
Well, heat causes various possibly deadly heat-related illnesses such as heat exhaustion and heat stroke due to hyperthermia. But it is also important to remember, as I already said, that people with underlying health conditions may suffer from other types of diseases that are just exacerbated during the heat.
One factor you say that could and avoid many deaths in the future is adaptation.
Yes.
What does that mean to adapt? To heat?
Adaptation is a complex process. There are different types of adaptation. People naturally adapt to heat over the course of the summer. So in the beginning of a summer, when you have a heat wave, it tends to be more deadly as opposed to a heat wave later in the summer because people have adapted to heat better over the course of the summer. But also over time, we as a society adapt to heat. So we built buildings that are more efficient. There are various types of measures that are implemented in the city, such as cooling centers mm-hmm. and educational programs so people know about the heat and they take the preventative measures and they have access to cool environments. So there are different types of adaptation. The way we defined adaptation in this study is by just how much heat-related mortality has reduced over time, and how can we project how the future impacts of heat-related mortality can look like based on those adaptation trends.
If as the summer goes along and the heat stays with us, does your body actually adapt to the heat being around you?
It depends. There are certain thresholds above which it will be difficult to adapt. And if you're an older person who has an impaired thermoregulation, then it will be more difficult to adapt. Mm-hmm. So to some extent we could, but it will be difficult to reach a real complete adaptation to heat.
Well, when you make your projection about the extreme scenario of 3,000 people could die each year, how do you arrive?
All right, so there are a couple of what we did in this study, and it was a really very complicated interdisciplinary approach we took because I'm an environmental epidemiologist by training, but we needed people with expertise in climate science, demography, and statistics to basically combine different types of projections. Mm-hmm. So we have projections about population change, how many people would live in the city. We have projections about the different climate scenarios that were used, a higher and a lower greenhouse gas emission scenario, various climate models, and also different adaptation pathways. So this specific estimate that you're mentioning, mm-hmm. It's a combination of being exposed to the higher greenhouse gas emission scenario, having a higher population in the city, not reaching a higher level of adaptation in the future, just seeing the population grow and grow more.
Yeah.
So it's just a combination of different factors. Mm-hmm. But I just want to mention that what we really tried to do here is really paint a landscape of future possibilities and explore how different scenarios may impact our population so we can better prepare.
You know, we're always talking about, this is being New York, we're talking about heat, it's a heat island, the concrete, whatever holds the heat in. Does that mean we're overlooking rural areas where heat might be a problem too much?
Heat is a problem in rural areas as well. But urban areas are really more susceptible due to the urban heat island effect and also due to the higher concentration of vulnerable individuals in urban areas. So we have mm-hmm. this combination of factors that just result in a greater burden of heat-related mortality.
Is there any cure for the increasingly hot weather? Or is it just global warming?
It's global warming. We can do things about it. We can try to stay on a lower greenhouse gas emission pathway. And I think what we can do as a society is just keep efforts, just increase our efforts to ensure adaptation of our residents.
Well, until then, if we continue and the global warming continues on as it's going, are we going to see the death toll rising as things get hotter or Earth keeps heating
up? It is difficult to predict. I think with this study, we have a better understanding of the kind of factors that influence heat-related mortality. If we see an unprecedented heat wave, mm-hmm. Extremely high temperatures, longer duration, we may see a substantial number of people dying. Mm-hmm. It is difficult to predict. There have been a lot of historical heat waves, even in Chicago in 1995. There has been a heat wave that took over 700 lives. So I don't think we are protected from heat. We just need to take the measures necessary to protect our population.
You know, I noticed that on the heat map of Australia, which just toasts in the summertime,
mm-hmm.
Do they have any lessons that we can learn about adjusting or adapting or
yes.
the future?
So this is a very good point because right now in the United States, we have regions such as the Northeast and the Midwest that are more susceptible to heat. Regions such as the South are less susceptible. But if temperature rise and we see temperatures we've never seen before, mm-hmm. maybe regions that are already better adapted, they may suffer from some additional heat-related deaths just because it is difficult to adapt to those very high temperatures. There may be power outages. It is very difficult to predict what may happen. So the lessons that we can learn from Australia is really the importance of heat adaptation planning, becoming more resilient as a society, and just making sure that there is a plan in place that is being implemented throughout the year.
And I would imagine that plan is more than just getting in an air-conditioned room. It must be urban planning.
It is urban
planning. And the electrical infrastructure, because, you know, we see trains breaking down, subways, things
yes.
that the rails expand, mm-hmm. and then stuff like that. So it takes a longer, a much more than just getting into a cool place.
Absolutely. And I think this is the way we have to think about our cities, just making sure that we're working towards the future where we have cities that are more resilient, cities that are more sustainable, where we really have access to various types of adaptations that make the life of people better at the same time and really help with addressing climate change challenges.
But in the meantime, we need to know how to recognize that we're in trouble as people getting overheated.
Absolutely. And something that every one of us can do. We all have elderly neighbors. We have parents, people we may think are susceptible. They may not realize it. So we can all just pay attention to those around us who may be at high risk and make sure that they know what they need to do to avoid such impacts.
And, you know, in this era of cell phones and things and the Internet of Things, maybe there will be devices that will automatically tell us, you know, your loved one's in trouble.
Absolutely.
Without them having to do it themselves.
Or just check in a couple of times a day.
What a quaint idea.
Yes.
Phone home, probably with a real telephone.
Yes.
No texting required. All right.
Yeah.
We hope that you stay cool this summer.
Yes, well, you too, and it was a real pleasure to be here.
Thank you. Dr. Elisaveta Petkova is a project director at the National Center for Disaster Preparedness at Columbia University. She's an author on new research out in environmental health perspectives last month. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to look at an interesting new patent Apple just received that seeks to disable your cell phone camera using infrared signals. It'll just turn the camera off. You know, people put their cameras up during concerts. This will allow them to turn the cameras off. Well, is this a good solution for concert venues? Or could it be a threat to civil liberties? So, like, if you want to take a photo of someone being arrested, like we've seen over the last few weeks, might it be used to turn your camera phone off? We'll talk about this after the break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. It is the summer concert season, but are you tired of going to these concerts and confronting a sea of iPhones and iPads held aloft above people's heads? Artists certainly are tired of this. Beyoncé, Adele, and others in recent years have pleaded with their fans to stop recording the performances. Well, Apple has a new patent for technology that would allow concert venues to disable phone cameras if they don't want you recording. The patent describes using infrared signals that, when beamed at the sensor in your camera, would instruct the phone to not record. This has had civil liberties advocates worried when the news broke last week. What if police use the same technology, for example? Just this week, cell phone video captured the killings in Louisiana, Minnesota, and last night in Dallas. What if this new technology could have shut down those camera phones? Where do our rights intersect with our personal devices? Here to talk about the science of how this kind of technology could work, plus what the law has to say about our smartphones, are my guests. Margot Kaminsky is Assistant Professor of Law at Ohio State University, focusing on technology and the law. Dr. Mark Messiri is a computer research scientist for NASA out of NASA Ames Research Center and Moffett Field, California. Welcome to Science Friday.
Cool. It's great.
Thank you for having us.
Mark, is this the new space age tech, something brand new, space age technology?
Not really. And actually, it's a fun reinvention, I think, of a technique that's been around for quite some time. The patent talks about, like you said, how to use a camera and an infrared light source for communication. That's something that we've been doing pretty much since the early 80s. Every TV remote control you've used since 1980 probably used a technology similar to this.
Hmm. So this is just taking what we know and making it do something else.
Right. And in this case, it's a little bit of a backward situation where you can imagine the stage or the movie screen or that picture frame telling the smartphone things like, don't record this movie, or this is a Ming vase in a museum, and it can provide that information to the smartphone. And then the software can, you know, provide an action where it doesn't allow you to record or may watermark that picture in a way that, you know, assigns copyright or other things.
So would this technology work with our existing phones, or would Apple have to add this feature to new products?
That's kind of the beauty of this is your the smartphones that we use today, people don't realize that the cameras actually see IR in a way that our eyes can't. So it's a really interesting way of hiding a signal that then you can pass to the smartphone.
Well, you know, spy versus spy. Could I put something on my phone that would block the infrared signal?
So it is very easy to pick up IR filters that are commonly used in photography and telescopes. You can pick up an IR filter for about $5 that would be able to filter wavelengths at about 650 nanometers. They actually do address this in the patent and talk about being able to use wavelengths that are not quite as common in the photography world. But I can't imagine a cottage industry springing up very quickly where you have like an iPhone protector that has a filter at the right frequency such that you could just filter those signals as they're trying to get to the camera. And at that point, your phone wouldn't be able to see any of those signals. And so effectively, you could disable and make this patent obsolete very quickly just with a clever filter on the lens.
Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, you say there are useful uses for it. For example, if you're in a museum and you want to learn about the exhibits or receive advertising you'd like, it would be projected
at you. Yeah. So today, we see a lot of QR codes and barcodes being used to identify things. I imagine the case that if you were in a museum and you saw a sticker with a weird, kind of digital picture on it, that could kind of detract from your experience of enjoying the art. In this case, because the signal's invisible, it actually doesn't interfere visually with the artwork at all. And what's kind of interesting about it is because it's digital communications, then you could also pass things like, you know, this is the Mona Lisa. It was painted in the early 1500s by Da Vinci. And that could be passed in the signal to the phone, and that wouldn't require an internet connection or anything else to pass that data in a way that QR codes and other things need that internet connection to pull that information forward.
Margo Kaminsky, if Apple were to go ahead and start licensing this technology for concert venues, would it violate property rights of any kind? If it's my phone, isn't it? I should decide if it's recording or not.
Well, Ira, it's a common misperception by individuals that they actually own their phone or own the software that's on their phones. It turns out that most of your relationship with your technology is not ownership, but in fact a licensing agreement, which means that most of the companies that create the software that's on your phones, such as the software Apple's considering using in this case, can usually update the software without your permission because of the licensing agreement that you've clicked through.
Mm-hmm. And do you see any legal issues here, or any rights issues, privacy issues here?
Oh, there are plenty of legal issues. I don't even know where to start. So the first issue is that obviously there are significant civil liberties implications to preventing people from recording things. We have a number of courts around the country that have recognized under the First Amendment, which protects freedom of speech, that there is some sort of right to record. And it's not really clear what that right entails. But for example, if you're a citizen and you use your cell phone to record the activities of the police, particularly involved in police activities or illicit police activities, a number of courts around the country have recognized that the First Amendment protects that activity. So if you envision a police department using this kind of technology, the First Amendment implications are pretty clear. When you get onto private property or start talking about private concert venues, then the conversation becomes much more tricky because that's not the state preventing you from recording something. That's somebody who owns the private property that you're on.
Mm-hmm. So how feasible, Mark, do you think this is?
I think it's feasible in certain situations. So if you're in, let's say, an enclosed environment where you don't have direct sunlight and lighting is very well controlled, there's already examples of technology like this being used in concert venues for things like synchronizing lights on bracelets and other things that people, you know, use during a concert. Where this breaks down and where the difficulty will be for this technology being implemented is if it's an outdoor venue during the day. It turns out that our sun emits a huge amount of IR light, and so you effectively have our sun jamming this signal. And so it would be very difficult for the phone to detect that signal. It would be like you and I trying to do Morse code with flashlights, let's say, across a parking lot. It's going to be very difficult for me to see the light coming out of your flashlight because the sun is shining so brightly and the ambient light is so high.
Let me go to the phones. We welcome your phone calls, 844-724-8255. Let's go to Mystic, Connecticut. And Eric, hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hey, Ira. I'm glad to talk to you. I saw you at the Maker Faire down in New York a while ago. I retired from the department for a major pharmaceutical company, and the fact that somebody got a patent for the technology really doesn't mean that it's going to be a problem for somebody to use it, unless Apple wants to sue somebody for using it. So the fact that technology exists,
We lost him. I think he had a bad cell phone connection. Mark, anything to that?
Sure. I completely agree. I mean, patents get issued all the time for things that don't get made. This is actually one of the major problems in our patent system, because you end up with potential blocking patents that then prevent new inventions from going forward. But the fact that it's sort of signaling out there as a type of technology that can be used, I think, is important, mm-hmm. and it's spurring important conversations around whether such technology should be used. And honestly, the type of participation people feel they're entitled to have when they go to things like private concerts.
Mm-hmm. You said there was a raft, not your exact word, of legal problems. Where do I begin? Give me a few more that would worry you.
Sure. So one of the more interesting ones actually is derivative of a 1970s case involving a human cannon performance at the Ohio State Fair. So there you had a TV station that went to the Ohio Fair and filmed the entirety of a guy's act where he shot himself out of a cannon. And this went up to the Supreme Court on a First Amendment challenge by the news media saying, you know, we have a right to film and broadcast matters of public concern. And the cannon performer, probably unsurprisingly, said, well, this isn't just a matter of public concern. This is my livelihood. And the Supreme Court said in that case, you know, when we're looking at these two things, yes, the livelihood of the human cannon performer outweighs any speech interests on the part of the media. So you think about this issue, this is not just a matter of, you know, asserting your rights to record the police. It's also a matter of trying to decide, what do we value more? Do we value civil liberties, or do we value the kind of property that potentially provides incentives for performers to create live concerts?
So has that been settled, or it's still open to interpretation?
Well, the things that potentially make that case limited are, one, the entire act was filmed rather than small portions of the act, and two, in that case, they didn't actually block the news media from filming it, and the court noted this. They said the real remedy here is that the human cannon performer is going to get some money out of the money that the news media made. When we're talking about this technology, we're talking about entirely blocking the videotaping of something in a private venue. And again, this might not be a First Amendment issue, because if a private venue imposes restrictions on you, that's largely, you know, it's not an action by the state. But it still has speech implications. So if you block everybody from filming everything in a concert mm-hmm. venue, there's a possibility that bad acts don't get recorded that have nothing whatsoever to do with the concert performance.
Let's go to Matt in San Francisco. Hi, Matt. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hey there. Hi, Ara.
Hi there.
So it's a tricky subject, because I realize civil liberty needs and all that, but I also, as a performer, and play in concert-type venues, I don't like to see cell phones or iPads, you know, lifted up. And I feel like we as performers also have rights to not have our performance reduced through a phone and the music reduced through, you know, the speakers or the microphones of a phone, and then going through YouTube and, you know, all the other outlets that people put them on. It really reduces the experience to me. Hmm. So, you know, I also favor the artist who want to have an intimate experience with their attendees and not have technology getting in the way of that.
All right, good point. Thanks for calling. Margo, Mark?
Well, from my standpoint, from a purely technological standpoint, it's one of those things where I think, frankly, for at least the way the patent is framed, that this is so easily disabled that I actually... I'm curious, given the time that has passed since the original patent was filed, we have much better ways of doing this with Bluetooth and RFID and other things now, that I would actually, from just a purely implementation standpoint, I'd be curious to see how well this would prevent folks from recording a live performance if they wanted to, and could get, for instance, the right filter or something else for their smartphone.
Just as a matter of question, you being an IT expert guy, is it Is it possible that that malicious people could hack our phones by using infrared information?
Well, any input to a digital system can be used as a method for misuse, right? So this would be no different than that. And so this really does fall into the same class of devices or the same class of threats as you would have with a lot of the more traditional, radio or RF-based communications that you would have with your phone.
Mm-hmm. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International, talking about a new technology Apple is patenting for its iPhone to block recordings. Marco, you mentioned the human cannonball guy and his right to do his performance. Is our caller, who is the performer, actually saying sort of the same thing?
Yes, I think he's having the exact sort of argument that the human cannonball performer made, which is this idea that, you know, it's my art and I need the incentive to be able to have a livelihood that enables me to perform my art. I also noted in our questioner's question or comment that there's also a sense by performers that they lose control over what the actual output is, and that meaningfully affects them as artists. Of course, the other side of the coin is that concertgoers do feel as though they're participating in the concert in a meaningful way, and largely when somebody goes to a concert, a huge amount of the experience is the social experience that they convey back to friends and family. So another reason why I'm not too concerned about this technology getting over-adopted is that I believe it would provoke a huge backlash by concertgoers who really enjoy experiencing things not just live at a concert, but also online and social media, communicating the kind of person they are to their family and their friends.
You'd be shooting yourself in the foot if you would implement it, basically, is what you're saying.
Let's
go to the phones, to Madison, Connecticut, and Valerie. Hi, Valerie.
Hi, Ira. I've always loved your show.
Thank you
for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I'm worried about a public safety aspect of this. One speaker previously sort of alluded to it, but not completely. I'm thinking about the tragedy in Paris and Orlando, and I'm thinking about how venues like that might want to use this technology to shut off our phones, and how useful it was for the people who were trapped inside to use their phones to reach safety people, first responders, and their loved ones. And I'll take the answer off the air, but I see that as a potential big conflict with this.
You mean because there were concerts going on, and had this been used, could the phones have been disabled, is what you're saying. Interesting.
Exactly. So could people have dialed out to 911, et cetera, as they did, during those two events?
Well, let me ask Mark Masseri. Mark, what do you think?
Yeah, so especially when you think back to like the Boston Marathon bombings, one of the great resources that law enforcement had after that was all of the cameras that were available to capture, basically a mosaic of the timeline of that event. If, for instance, that event was canvassed with a device like this that was disabling the ability for cameras to take pictures, then you would lose the ability for that evidence to be captured ahead of time. And so to what the caller was referring there, if you had pictures that were being taken in the venue while the concert was going on, that may actually help you post-disaster in recreating what it was that actually happened.
Mm-hmm. And last question for you, Mark. For people who are worried about the interference with their civil liberties or privacy, are there other technologies that we should be paying more closer attention to than this?
Yeah, from when you think about threats, and one of the ways that you kind of evaluate those types of threats is, what is the ease of connecting to those systems? What is the range and the bandwidth for which I can connect to those systems? This kind of sits at the low end of that spectrum. Right? Your radio technologies, all these phones now have Wi-Fi and Bluetooth, RFID, cell phone communications. There are much richer surfaces that you could look at attacking as a platform than this, where you have to be within proximity of the camera and you have to be able to generate this very specific type of light source to make that happen. And so it seems, at least to me, that it's less of a threat than some of the radio technologies that are built into these phones.
All right, Dr. Mark Masseri, a computer scientist at NASA. Dr. Margo Kaminsky, assistant professor of law at Ohio State University. Thank you for joining us, and have a good weekend. We're going to take a break and talk about a story of a former science teacher who shook up violin making. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Ah, the sweet sound of the string quartet, violin, viola, cello, and bass, working together in perfect musical harmony. At least, that's what I hear. When Carlene Hutchins listened to a string quartet, she heard room for improvement. Hutchins was a luthier, a maker of violins, and not just any luthier. Over half a century, this former schoolteacher, science teacher, upended the world of violin making by bringing science to the woodworking table. In her basement lab, she took apart her creations, running hundreds of experiments to figure out what makes a violin sing. And she even one-upped the string quartet. She created her own violin octet, tackling problems with the original violin family that had plagued violin makers for centuries. We'll hear a little of that octet later. Quincy Whitney tells Carlene's story in her new biography. It's called American Luthier, The Art and Science of the Violin. She joins me from Boston to talk about it. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you very much, Ira. I'm honored to be here.
Well, thank you. Let's start at the beginning. I mean, how does this grade school science teacher get hooked on violin making?
It's actually a whim and a dare, and then also a creative outlet. It's a whim because she used to whittle. She started whittling when she was a tomboy, about age 6, and she had this $75 viola in her hands and just kept thinking maybe she could make it better. It was a dare because her best friend, Helen Rice, just said it was an impossible task, and why would she try to do that? And it took her 2 years to make one. And it was a creative outlet because she just left her job. She just became a new mom at a rather late age of 36, and I think she needed an outlet badly, and it became carving the plates of her first viola.
How does she decide that the standard, you know, quartet, string quartet, is not good enough?
It's not that she decided that. It's that after she had been studying acoustics with retired Harvard physicist Frederick Saunders and doing experiments, and after she had also been making about 35 violins with a German violin maker, learning that craft, she got a knock on her door one day at 112 Essex Avenue in Montclair, New Jersey, and it was composer Henry Brandt from Vermont, who had read some articles about this New Jersey housewife violin maker who was making a little bit of news. And he sort of confronted her with the question. He said, you know, medieval instruments, we have families of instruments in the Renaissance that are recorders, we have families of viols, but we've never really had a family of violins. And what do you think? Do you think you could make one? So with the question, she sort of decided she would try it, and it took her the next decade to do that.
So she creates a whole new family of violins.
Yeah, it's really based on the fact that the string quartet has been considered a bit of a sacred cow for many centuries, and everybody thinks it's perfect, but actually tonally it lacks. It lacks a true tenor voice and also a true alto voice. In fact, in 1690, Stradivari actually got an order for two alto violins that were going to be played as a contralto and a tenor. So if you look at the string quartet today, sometimes the second violin will play an alto part or the viola will play a tenor part, but there are alto and tenor gaps in the middle of the string quartet. And that really became the sort of focus for these 8 violins across the range of a piano.
Huh. I always thought where the violins leave off, then the viola picks up there, and the viola leaves off, the cello picks up. You're saying there are gaps instead.
If you look at a family of recorders or a family of viols, it's like the range of the human voice. You have, and that's exactly what these 8 instruments are. They're across the range of the human voice. So it starts with a treble, and then a soprano, and a mezzo, an alto, a tenor, a baritone, a bass, and a contrabass. So in that way, you see how complete the range is with 8 instruments because it's across the range of the piano.
So she created the piano for the violin, basically.
Basically, a range, range that would fill in the gaps. And also, they were tonally matched so that the violin, each one sounds, has the same dynamics. The treble, the tiny 11-inch treble, can compete with the contrabass in terms of dynamics and pizzicato, and that's sort of revolutionary, too.
Okay, now let's talk about her as an experimenter. She's an engineer. And she doesn't just, she starts her work by saying, you know, I have to take these things apart to understand how they work, right? And that doesn't go over so well with some of the violinists.
Yeah, actually, she starts by suggesting that science could make a better fiddle. And that upsets the violin world because, of course, they're copying Stradivari for three centuries now, thinking that they've got he perfected the craft. But she's suggesting, first of all, that it was okay to apply science to the woodworking shop for the violin maker. And the violin maker was giving her a hard time about the fact that she might be demystifying the art. And she used to laugh at that because she said, of course, if you can't separate acoustics from music, music is science. And sometimes we forget that. We marginalize it as art only, but we can't separate acoustics from music.
Interesting. So she creates what's called the Swiss cheese violin. What was that?
One of her most dramatic experiments with Saunders, I think that might have been after Saunders, was a Swiss cheese violin where she punched 64 holes in the ribs of a violin and then plugged each full hole with cotton. And then as she and Saunders were playing that instrument, they would pull cotton out and see what happened to the sound. She always said that we did the right thing for the wrong reason because they thought originally that they were studying the wood modes. And then they realized that maybe the more important thing to study were the air currents inside the box. And there might be hundreds of air currents. And Carlene spent 50 years studying basically the relationship between two different ones.
Because, you know, we always hear with Stradivari, it was great because he had the right wood and the right pattern. And you're saying she discovered it was the air that was really
we could look at the violin as a wind instrument. The other thing people forget is that Stradivari was, in fact, a contemporary maker. He wasn't copying anybody. He was making instruments. So in his time, you could buy a contemporary instrument from Stradivari. And what's happened, hence, is that three centuries, violin makers have thought they had to just copy Amati, Guarneri, and Stradivari. And she was suggesting that just maybe we could go further than that.
So she does some more research. She does some experiments with Christmas glitter. Tell us about that.
Yeah. Ernst Chladni was the German physicist who started sort of showing the footprints of sound by taking plates. This is like the 1780s. He published a whole paper on it where you could take sand grains and put it on a plate and then vibrate the plate at different frequencies, and different geometric patterns would form. The parts of the plate that's vibrating, the sand falls away from, to the nodes where the plate is not vibrating. So it becomes these beautiful geometric patterns at different frequencies. And Carlene decided to apply that to a free violin plate, which is a top or back plate that's not connected to the ribs. And then when she saw these different patterns, she started to use it as a guide to where she had to keep carving the plate. The luthier is always looking for that ratio between stiffness and flexibility, which has to do with carving that plate in a meticulous way. And Stradivari, Amati, she was always saying that the old Italian masters had learned to do it intuitively by touching and tapping, and that this was merely a guide to help modern luthiers do it more consistently.
So she got certain tones in the plate from putting the glitter on it, and when she discovered from people who knew music that, that's the right tone, she knew how to then make the next piece of wood do exactly the same thing.
It wasn't quite that simple. It was hundreds of hours of trial and error.
Wow.
She would carve a plate, and then she would put the whole instrument together and give it to a player and get a reaction and see what the player thought. And then she'd go back to the drawing board, take it apart, recarve it, test it again with the Christmas glitter, and then all over again. Hundreds and hundreds of hours of cut and try.
Wow. So I'll just to pay tribute to her and talk more about it, let's listen to her, Carlene Hutchinson's new violin family. This is a group called the Hutchins Consort, playing a tune you might recognize.
Thank you.
Of course, that's Gershwin's Summertime. Quincy, how would you describe this octet sound?
It's like something you've never heard before. It's a new palette of sound in stringed instruments. It's revolutionary. I listened particularly to that piece about 11 times when the Hutchins Consort was on an East Coast tour in 2011. They're an amazing group. They play everything from medieval and Renaissance to jazz and modern. They do about 40 concerts a year and on the West Coast. And I'm really hoping that they can come back for an East Coast tour now that the book is out, because they've been waiting for the book, because the book has a chapter on them and tells their story.
So how do you describe the sound differently from if it were just a regular string quartet?
The balance is amazing, and the fact that the dynamics are amazing also. The treble can talk back to the contrabass. The pizzicato is phenomenal. The pizzicato is, of course, the plucked string, and that's where you really hear the dynamics of an instrument. You hear how lots of times in an orchestra, if you look at the reconfiguration of the orchestra, we have 30 violins to one or two brass instruments. And I've had a cellist who plays her baritone, Akua Dixon, say that she could finally play a duo with her maybe former spouse, I'm not sure, who is a wind player. So one string instrument could play with a wind instrument in an equal way, because those dynamics and resonances are more powerful now with the research of Carlene Hutchins.
Is it easy to find someone who's playing the octet or a group of people if you wanted to?
They're very unusual. Yeah. She made 7 octets, and 4 of them are in museums, unfortunately not being played, although one in Edinburgh can actually be loaned to players. But the only ensemble currently is the Hutchins Consort in San Diego, California. But there are about 7 luthiers now, 7 to 10, who are students of Hutchins. And if someone ordered one octet tomorrow, an alto, a baritone, any of them, they could make them. In fact, there are luthiers who have them now, who've made them.
What would it cost to make one?
I think that going price would be anywhere from 5 to 10. I'm not sure. $5,000 to $10,000. It just depends on where that is in the luthier's repertoire at this point.
All right. We're talking to Quincy Whitney. Telling the story of the American Luthier, the Art and Science of the Violin, great new book on Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. But you couldn't really, is there any place to actually put an order in for one, or can a group get started if they wanted to with a group of them?
Actually, that's a great question, and it's something I should answer on my website. That's one thing I have not answered. If someone would like to order one, I can certainly list those luthiers on my website that would be able to produce one. Some of them have already have them in their repertoire. They already have them in their shop. And there's one particular one there's a maker out in New Mexico who has really focused on the vertical viola big time and thought it was this whole solution, you know, for violists if they would be willing to play something vertically. And that's not as happened as greatly as she would like, but there are luthiers that make these instruments.
Yeah. You knew Carlene for 12 years. What kind of person was she?
She was conflicted a little bit, but and contradictory. She would always talk fiddles with anyone who walked in the door. She was a generous spirit in terms of a teacher, but she was very private with respect to her personal life and her personal expression. But she was a very generous, passionate kind of person who sort of got taken away by her passion. She was a mother of two. But I think she found it difficult sometimes to put the pieces of her passion together with parenting. She was very lucky to have a modern spouse who basically raised the children, because she was taken away so much with her fiddles. But a very kind person and generous-spirited and very determined. She was a taskmaster when it came to being a teacher, too.
How did you bump into her?
I was a Boston Globe arts reporter for the New Hampshire Weekly section of the Sunday Globe for 14 years, and someone said to me at a New Hampshire Humanities Council meeting that if I covered the arts, I ought to go meet this violin maker who lives up in Lake Winnipesaukee in New Hampshire. So I did. I called her up and I said, "This is Quincy Whitney with the Boston Globe, and I'd like to do a story on you." And she said, "No, I don't have time." And I thought, this is an 87-year-old woman who doesn't need me. And I was very intrigued. So I hung on the phone thinking, what else could I say? And she said, "What's your angle?" And the first thing that came to mind was the truth. I said, "I'm interested in stories where science and art overlap." And she said, "Well, that's exactly what I do. When do we talk?"
Wow. And how much more difficult, is it more difficult for regular string musicians to play the octet?
There is definitely a learning curve. And the Hutchins consort players can particularly address that. And depending on the instrument, which of the eight you're playing, there are more or less adjustments. The real conundrum at the center of the octet is the alto, which is a vertical viola. So, of course, the joke is that violists have to, in some sense, be trained as a cellist. But that's also just a conundrum. There's also two other instruments, that the baritone and the tenor, that are opportunities for cellists. So it just depends on which instrument you're playing. There's a Russian virtuoso on the treble, Grigory Seduk, who is a St. Petersburg Philharmonic player. And to listen to this man on the treble is an amazing, controversial, and revolutionary experience, because you can't believe his fingers can overlap the way they do on the strings and cover such a tiny instrument.
So it's like having a cell phone trying to play an instrument.
Yes.
The keyboard's so tiny. The strings are so small, close together.
But Grigory's an amazing virtuoso on it.
Yeah, well, I guess there are albums out there somewhere that we can listen to.
I would suggest everyone should go to my website, which is quincywhitney.com, but also thehutchinsconsort.org, and for further information about their recordings.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much, Quincy, for taking time to talk with us. Great book.
Ira, thank you.
Quincy Whitney is the author of American Luthier, The Art and Science of the Violin. And if you want to listen a little bit, we ask you to go to our website at sciencefriday.com/violin, and you can hear some of the Hutchins Violin Octet on our website. That's about all the time we have. BJ Lederman composed our theme music. No octet there, BJ. Our thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City and the University of New York. And always, you can go to our website, listen to that octet, and also we have a new video up there this week, and all kinds of projects for the summer and summer book reading, all kinds of stuff for you to enjoy, to take along with you. And if you're taking us, and if you like us on Science Friday at SciFry on Facebook, and we tweet all week. Please have a safe and fresh and cool holiday weekend. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.